Greetings, everybody. This is John Loeffler. Welcome to Lifetime Income. And today's Lifetime Income is an encore presentation of a program we heard earlier in the year.
The Financial Sense Lifetime Income Program. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team, Jim Poplava and John Loeffler.
Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplava, and welcome to a recessed version of Lifetime Income. Each day, 10,000 baby boomers head into retirement. But unlike their parents, they no longer have the defined benefit pension plans. All they have is what they've saved and maybe Social Security. Joining me to discuss the crisis in retirement planning is Professor Robert Merton. He's professor of finance at the MIT Sloan School of Business Management and professor emeritus at Harvard University. He's also a recipient of the Nobel Prize for Economics. Professor, the rise of defined contribution plans reduce the liabilities of business, but as you have noted, it increases the likelihood of a major pension crisis down the road for baby boomers. As you look at the landscape today, with 10,000 boomers turning 65 every day for many years to come, is a pension crisis inevitable, in your opinion?
Well, there's going to have to be some major adjustments, and I'm still a little bit hopeful we can deal with it. On the other hand, it is a very serious challenge to us that we have to stress. And for the near-term baby boomers as a group, I don't mean any one individual, they're probably a little more protected because so many of them had DB plans for most of their work life, or at least the ones that did. Where we're going to see it really come in is with the somewhat later baby boomers or each new generation where the bulk of their employer plan accumulation is coming from defined contribution and not from DB plans. And, you know, if you look at what the simple calculation is that, you know, there are three sources of retirement funding: government, like Social Security, employer plans, such as either DB or DC, or personal saving. I don't think very many people are optimistic that government Social Security is going to be increased. We are mostly hoping it'll just at least not be decreased. Employer plans, as you already noted in your introduction, they got out of it because it was too expensive. So they clearly didn't replace it with a plan that has as much benefits in it as the old DB plans. So those have gone down, which means to maintain the benefits, the only way we can do that is either to save more personally, which is not an easy thing to do, or, as I could mention for a moment somewhere in the interview, there are some ways in which we can get some more benefits out of the assets we have. But that's just the basic thing. The other thing is that the good news, the next generations are going to live longer. That's the good news. The complication with that is that if you're going to live longer, we're going to have to be able to come up with more funding for retirement, or either work longer or live at a lower standard of living and save more. Those are, you know, invariant facts. So we do have this big challenge and problem in terms of what we can do about it. We have, as I already mentioned, the only way you can get more benefits is to work longer or save more. Taking more risk is more complicated, and we could discuss that if you want, but that's not necessarily the best thing to do. Or get more out of the assets we have. And so that's the challenge. How do we make that transition?
How does the current period of zero interest rates and the possibility, as mentioned recently on Capitol Hill with Chairman Janet Yellen, of negative interest rates bring us closer to a pension crisis?
Well, there, the pension crisis is not just involving people with DC plans. Now, the big problem for defined benefit plans is they've made a great number of promises of paying out income, and they funded them with their pension funds. However, they didn't put their investments into the same kinds of instruments that will assure income. You know, they speculated. Speculation is wrong. They took risks and invested in assets other than bonds of the kind that would sustain the income if they promised. As a result of that, when interest rates go down, as they have for some years now, and stayed low, the pension funds and insurance companies that have done annuities have been under enormous pressures because they've promised these payments, but at the new low interest rates, they need a lot more money to make those same income payments, and they don't have them. And so that's put a lot of pressure on that part of the retirement system. Clearly, for a baby boomer or anyone else saving, for the same amount of money saved, if interest rates are lower, you can't support as much income. Or put the other way, if you want to sustain the same income when interest rates are lower, you're going to have to save a lot more money. Either way, low interest rates, and I mean here by low interest rates, low inflation protected interest rates, because you can have high interest rate, but if you have high inflation, you really don't gain. But in any case, low interest rates have that impact both on the defined benefit side as well as defined contribution.
I want to talk about 401k plans. Why do you think the performance metrics for, let's say, a 401k plan is different? In other words, it isn't measured in terms of producing a desired level of retirement income, such as Social Security, or, for that matter, defined benefit plans.
That's an excellent question, and one doesn't know precisely. My belief is that the defined contribution plans are, with exception, there's certain areas in education where they've been used for a long, long time, but they're 403 and not this. But 401 is, when it first came in many years ago, it was really put into the pension system as a kind of a supplement. It was a supplement to people who already had Social Security and a nice defined benefit plan, typically for higher earners in the firms, where they wanted to have more savings for retirement, you know, sort of top up, or it's supplemental for higher income people. And because of the nature of that, and because they essentially had a guaranteed stream of income from both Social Security and their defined benefit plan, a lot of the people were not that concerned on getting, you know, sort of specific income, but sort of saw this topped up money as more of a savings plan, really, than a retirement one. Whatever the reason is, in D.C., we report to people what their asset value is, which is the wealth or how much their account is worth, not how much income it could buy. And that's a very big problem for us in terms of understanding, measuring risk, conveying to people how they're doing. It's very easy to think, if you look at a big pot of money, oh, I'm rich, I can live very, very well, until you look at how much income you need and then how much it takes to buy that income. And then you discover in terms of income, it's not that large. And so I can't exactly tell you for sure why it happened, but I can tell you that's the way it's done. That's the way the rules are written by Department of Labor and SEC and so forth, that we have to report ups and downs of the value of the account, not in terms of how much income you could buy, but in terms of what it's worth. And that gives a very distorted sense of what is risky and what's not risky, as well as how well we're not doing.
And along those lines, when we talk about risk, explain the seeds of the coming pension crisis could lie in the fact that a lot of investment decisions are being made with a misguided view of risk.
Yes, I think, first of all, that one of the complications of defined contribution plans you did not have with the defined benefit plans is it shifted the decision making as to what you hold and what you invest in and how, et cetera, to the individual. And that's a very complicated problem. Understanding risk in terms of investments and so forth is very complicated. People who do that full time for a living, it's very complicated. And to ask people, including my brilliant colleagues here at MIT, some of them with 150 IQs and 3 degrees, to ask them to make decisions about risk and return and what they should invest in doesn't make a lot of sense. It has nothing to do with how well educated they are, smart they are. This is like asking people to do their own surgeries. We wouldn't expect them to do that, and we really shouldn't expect them to be making these complicated risk return decisions about their retirement portfolios. So that's the first order effect. The second one is, and we've made some progress in trying to help in D.C. here. I don't want to say we haven't done it. There's pooled portfolios and so forth. But it's still left to the individual to decide, which was not something they had to do with DB, never did in the past, didn't know how to do in the present, and probably won't be able to do very well in the future. So we have to address that. The second thing that is really wrong, as I already alluded to, but it's very important, because we report how you're doing and the risk is measured in terms of the change in value or the volatility of the value of the account that's invested in versus the income, really distorts what's risk and not. Maybe I can give you a very quick example I think that everybody could relate to. If you had come 9 or 10 years ago to an advisor and said, I'm very unsophisticated, I don't like to take risk, I have $1 million, which is a lot of money, but I really need to live on it, put me in the safe thing. Well, if I wasn't thinking and I thought safety meant make sure that $1 million doesn't lose. I could have gone to a bank and gotten an insured deposit, certificate of deposit, full faith and credit of the government, and put your money in it. And you would have earned maybe 4 or 5%, which means on your $1 million, your income would have been $40,000, $50,000 a year. Okay. What would you get for your $1 million in that same insured bank account today? 0.1%. That's $1,000 per million. $1,000 income on $1 million saving. So look at the situation. Between 9 years ago and now, we've preserved the $1 million. It's been absolutely safe through all the crises we've had. But what about your income? You used to get $40,000 or $50,000. Now you're getting $1,000. You can't remotely live on $1,000 if you were living on $40,000 or $50,000. So although your value changed not at all, the income fell 40-fold. It fell from $40,000 or $50,000 down to $1,000. I can't think of any more dramatic way to see how risky a asset that is very safe in terms of preserving your value is in terms of income. And you can't do both. You can either take safe income, where you lock in or guaranteed income, or you can have guaranteed or safe value. You can't have both. And so for most, you know, retirement purposes, what matters is not how much your pot of money is worth, but how much income that you can have on a regular basis for the rest of your life. And that's what defines standard living for all of us, not a pot of money.
You know, this is something you just mentioned in that example that I've tried to stress. For example, during the financial crisis, let's say you owned shares of Coca-Cola at the beginning of the crisis. During that crisis period, the stock market went down, Coke lost a third of its value, but the dividend never changed, number one. And number two, every single year, they raised the dividend 7% a year. So at the end of the crisis in 2009, your income went up during the crisis instead of falling, even though the assets fell. On top of that, a year later, it was right up where it used to be before the crisis, which gets me to the question, when we look at risk, why is there not more emphasis on eliminating income volatility versus the market's infatuation with price volatility?
Well, again, it depends what your goal is for your investing. If I need a certain amount of money in 6 months or a year to pay a bill or to pay tuition or something else, I want to make sure I have that money. Then I'm not so interested in income preservation as I am in making sure I have the right amount of money to pay that bill. But in the case of retirement, of course, that's a different goal. And the goal here is a standard of living, and that is income. Now, your reference to stocks, I have to say, is a more complicated one. While you're correct that if Coca-Cola maintains its dividend, then even if its price goes down, you're still getting the same income. But unlike, let's say, a full faith and credit U.S. government bond, 30-year bond or whatever, you know, maybe not Coca-Cola, but other companies, one of the reasons their stock has gone down is because times are not as good. And when times are not as good, they may cut the dividend. And so it may still be a percent. If I know for sure the dividend's going to be paid, then it's like a government bond. That's easy. But I don't think anyone can represent, even for the finest of companies, that the dividend is a kind of sure income in the sense of a treasury bond or a similar type of instrument. I mean, that doesn't mean it's not a good idea to buy stocks, and it doesn't mean it's not a good idea to have a dividend payer. I'm simply saying that those are different, that it really is the case that companies do cut their dividends when times get tough. And one of the reasons that prices go down is times are tough. And so we can't just have that same assurance. What I'm really talking about here is, what is your goal? Then we'll figure out what are the vehicles for doing it and having to do it. And it may be, in fact, it probably would be, that holding shares for most people will be a necessity of risk to take in order to try to get to the goal of retirement that they'll need. So I'm not saying anything negative about it. I just think we have to be very careful about treating things that are not essentially guaranteed as if they were.
So if we take a look at an income-focused pension strategy, how should a plan provider change the way they communicate, engage with savers putting money into the plan?
Well, the first thing I would say is that, you know, again, every planner has a different approach, but I think there's a schematic. I think first you have to have the client or whoever you're advising understand what are they trying to achieve, a good retirement, and what's a good retirement? Well, you have to help them to think about that in terms of, I would say, a good retirement would be if I can sustain the standard of living that I've enjoyed in the latter part of my work life and gotten used to, if I can sustain that standard of living for the rest of my life in retirement, that's a pretty good retirement. I mean, we'd all like more, but as someone at an age where it's not a hypothetical, even though I'm not retired, I can promise you that if you have your health, you're not going to want to live at a lower standard of living than you've been used to. And if you don't have your health, then you need really a lot of money. So, you know, I think that's a reasonable definition of good retirement. Now, if the client agrees to that, then you can say, okay, well, how do we define a standard living in retirement? And we already discussed, it's a stream of income, ideally protected against inflation, so you can really sustain that standard. And so you explain that to the client. They can see it. After all, that's what Social Security does, as you mentioned, DB does, has done. So that's a very traditional description of a retirement goal. And then we would say, in order to sustain your standard of living, if you're living at a level you are earning, say, $80,000 a year, and we want to sustain that, probably at retirement, if you've been living on $80,000, and that's, you know, what you live on, you'd need something less than that, you know, maybe 80 or 90%, some number, don't hold me to the number, in order to sustain it. The reason you need less money is that during your work life, you're saving for retirement. So a large part of what you earn goes to saving. But once you retire, you don't have to save anymore. So maybe, let's say it's 80%. So you say, well, to live in a good style of living that you're used to, given you're living on, you know, been earning 80, you'd need about 65. Then you would say, okay, so our goal is to get you to 65 a year, starting at whatever retirement age. And that's what we're going to try to get for you. And then you say, well, if I had enough money or enough saving, maybe I could put it all in, you know, safe, absolutely safe U.S. government bonds that will accrue to enough to pay that amount of income for life. That'd be great, but few of us have that much money. And so we say, we can't get there without taking some risk. And so we say, okay, depending on the person, you say, you know, the only way you can do better is either save more if you don't want to take more risk or work longer. Or take more risk. And if it's take more risk, then you put some in stocks or other things, knowing that it may not work out, but knowing that this is a way to get to where you want. That's the process. But along the way, you report to them. The most important thing, you don't report to them what their account is worth. I mean, you can, you have to by law, but that's not the thing you emphasize. What you say is, we have a goal of getting you 65. For what you have in your account and for what you're likely to contribute in the future, right now, we can get you the equivalent of 55. Let's just make up a number. So what you have now and what you contribute, we can get you to 55. But you want 65, so you're almost there. I mean, you're 5-6 there. We'll take some risk, see if we can get you there. If the day comes when I get you to 65 and I say, hey, we've got enough money now that we can buy absolutely, you know, essentially safe, guaranteed U.S. government or whatever income to match that 65, then I'm probably going to say to you, do you want to change your goal? Do you want to try to go and live at a higher level? Or are you comfortable with the 65 and you like the idea that you don't have to worry about it and you can live the rest of your life at that standard of living no matter how long you live? If the answer you give me is yes, then I'm going to take all the risk off the table because the whole purpose of these investments was to get you to that goal. And if I play with your investments with risk at that point, I can't improve the goal. I can make you wealthier, but I can't improve the goal. But if it goes the wrong way, you could be below your goal again. I would have failed you. So that's the process. I don't know if that's too quick, but that's the process that I see is the way to do it. And by the way, that's the way corporations and governments who have defined benefit plans or who have obligations to make these payments, that's how they think about the investment process. They have a goal of funding requirement. That goal is income. The thing they measure when they talk to the CFO or the CFO talks about the pensions to the board or to the CEO, they don't talk about rates of return. They don't talk about how big the pot of money is in the fund. What they tell them is our funded ratio has either gone up or down. All a funded ratio is what I just described. How much income could you buy with what we have in the fund now versus what is it that we've promised people, the 55-65 I mentioned to you, and we say, hey, our funded ratios go up. That means we can buy more income and we're closer to our income goal than in the past. That's good news. And that's what the CEO and the CFO wants to tell the CEO and the board, because it means our pension has gotten stronger. We don't have to put as much into contributions. Therefore, we can spend more money on expansion or R&D. If I have to go in and say, on the other hand, whoops, our funded ratios go down, means we are farther from our goal of what we can fund, of what we promised, then I have to tell them, sorry, the money you were going to spend on expanding the company has to go into the pension fund. They don't like that. So I'm telling you that story to see right now in the most sophisticated retirement investment investors in the world, defined benefit pension plans, that's precisely what they do. And what I think we need to do for DC is the parallel to that. We report to people how they're doing relative to their income goal, and we report to people how much they're worth, because those are two different things. And for retirement, how much you're worth, as you saw before, isn't a very good indicator. If I'm getting $1,000 a year income, the fact I'm worth $1 million doesn't help me very much.
Sticking with the idea of income, explain the distinction between words such as minimum guaranteed income and conservatively flexible income and the role that each could play in a retirement portfolio.
Well, I have to confess to you that those two terms are not well defined. I'm not quite sure what they mean. I suspect normally in this world of what we have, the very strict regulations in financial services, what you can say, the word guaranteed usually means you're guaranteeing it. That's like an insurance company writes an annuity and guarantees income or something like that. If someone used the term guaranteed when it's not, no one is actually promised that they will pay it under penalty of going bankrupt, then I think they're probably on thin ice. So I assume that's what guaranteed means. Flexible, I assume, means it's not guaranteed. But those terms aren't ones that I know to be well-defined.
So, given the circumstances that we find ourselves in, we have a large population moving into retirement. Many could have defined contribution plans instead of DB plans. And given the level of interest rates, are you optimistic, Professor, that we can avoid a pension crisis, or will we need a crisis to force the necessary changes in the system?
Well, we had an opportunity. If we're going to have a crisis, in some way, we had it when interest rates were really, really low. They'd come up a little bit. And when the stock market was really low a few years ago, it didn't happen because this is a different kind of crisis than the one that we're used to. You know, like the stock market, the big crisis of 2008, 2009 was very dramatic. We saw stock prices, as you indicated, drop by a third. We saw all kinds of big shocks hit the system, and there were reactions to it. That isn't what typically happens in retirement crisis. What happens is we're paying it out, that people are getting paid, there's enough money in the till to pay people this year or next year's retirement and so forth. Where you're looking at is you can see that you're not going to be able to sustain that unless you vastly increase the resources. So one of the issues, you say when the crisis hits, it's not likely to hit in the same way like a stock market crash or something very dramatic. It's going to be, in fact, we probably are already there in some respects, that in many sectors of the economy, public sector in particular, the funding of the benefits is way, way below what they've promised. And somewhere or another, that money's going to have to be gotten. And we can be hopeful, but it'll happen. But so first I wanted to say to you is the crisis won't be something that happens like a stock crash. We'll all then, you know, band together and do it. And that's what makes it difficult to address. That said, I believe that it is a problem that can be solved. In that sense, it's an engineering problem, not a science problem, in that we know what it would take to do it. We know how we can run DC plans and contribution rates to provide targeted levels of income. And, you know, we'll have to get there. I am cautiously optimistic that the industry has moved a lot in the last 10 or 11 years since I got deeply involved in this area. And now it's becoming gradually more focused on income to talk about things, has developed new kinds of instruments, funds, and so forth that are a little easier for people to understand and they don't have to make as many decisions. The introduction of default that the pension, the 206 Act created, where you essentially, if you're in a DC plan, you get defaulted in and then they put you in a default funds. Those default funds can be a lot better than what most people would do for themselves. And so it's helping a little there. I think that, as I mentioned earlier in the interview, there's an adding up condition. If our employer benefits are down, if government benefits are not going up, we have to save more or get more out of the assets we have. in working in middle class, not just America, but the world, almost everywhere except the very, very least developed countries, the working and middle class equivalent there, the only personal saving they do is their house. They have a house and they have a bank account. People who have stocks and bonds and things like that are upper middle class to affluent. But working middle class people have very little other saving. So if we're going to increase personal saving, other than by passing a law that says people have to contribute forced contributions, it's going to take a long time to change behavior. So a practical way that we can help with all the other things besides designing well-functioning DC plans and so forth, one of the ways we need to get more out of our assets. And there are only two, in my view, two big needle changes in that regard. One is the annuity, where people, which is just what a defined benefit plan is. When you retire, you get paid for the rest of your life an income and then nothing more. An annuity is something you can buy where you give the money to an insurance company. The insurance company pays you for the rest of your life, no matter how long you live. And then when you no longer are living, that's the end of it. The advantage of the annuity, if it's done well, and I underscore if it's done well, is that you get more of a payment for life than you would if you're just living on your interest, because you're willing to give up the money that you have when you don't need it, when you've gone someplace where you don't need money, a better place, I hope. And that's a big way. So if the interest rate's 2% at 65, I might get 6%. So they'll say to me, for each $1,000, we'll pay you $60 a year versus $20 a year, and you'll get it for the rest of your life. So as long as you need it, you get it. So annuities, well done, are going to be a critical factor in helping working middle class people to use their assets more efficiently and effectively to get what they need. The other is the reverse mortgage, which I hate the name of it, and it has a spotty history. And frankly, I think it's not a particularly well-designed, well-executed product today. But the advantage of the reverse mortgage is it's a way for you to take the house, which, as I mentioned, is the biggest personal asset that the retirees have, and take the house and recognize the house is where you want to live in retirement, and it's a good hedge for most of your consumption, so you should own it and live in it, and it's the house you want. But the house is going to last longer than you are, and when you no longer need it, it's just going to become a financial asset, because everywhere in the world has become industrialized, whether it's China, let alone the United States. Children don't move into their parents' house to live the next generation. That's not the practice. So the house will be sold. What the reverse mortgage allows you to do is to access that extra value, the value when you don't need the house, and bring that value back to when you retire and use the money that that generates, ideally to buy further annuities so that you can have a higher stream of income for the rest of your life than you could otherwise have. You still own the house. You still can stay in the house as long as you want, or as long as you need to, which is usually the rest of your life in retirement. And, you know, you're there. Now, I'm not advertising reverse mortgage, and I want me to say, because this is on public radio or whatever, that, you know, you need to know what you're doing. And there are bad versions of annuities, high cost. There are bad versions of reverse mortgages that are high cost. But I believe that's going to be the savior, reverse mortgage and the proper use of annuities for the working middle class, in addition to getting these DC plans right and focusing on income. We're going to need it all to get through it. But I lived long enough and have enough optimism that survival of the species or survival of us is a pretty strong instinct. And I think we will, maybe in a muddled way, but we will find a way to implement these things and get there, because the alternative is just not acceptable. So I guess I could say that's a somewhat optimistic hope, but only if we actually execute the kinds of things that I've been talking about. If we pay no attention to it and do nothing, then we can run into a wall that will be very ugly.
You know, Professor, as we close, if our listeners would like to read your article, which caught my attention, The Crisis in Retirement Planning, Our Approach to Saving is All Wrong, We Need to Think About Monthly Income, Not Net Worth, how could they do so?
Well, it was published in the Harvard Business Review, July, August 2014. I mean, obviously, I have copies of the article, but I'm not in a position where, you know, it's a copyrighted article like magazines. The place to go would be to go, I guess, Google or something, and try to get in touch with the Harvard Business Review and see if there's a way to read the article.
Well, Professor, I want to thank you for joining us on Lifetime Income Program. Your article is very interesting because it does point to a problem that many retirees are dealing with today as we've moved from DB to DC plans and also a low interest rate environment. I want to thank you for joining us on the program.
Okay, well, thank you. And I just would say one more thing, just so that people feel better. I really know firsthand, I'm not pushing it, that there are in the industry now products being developed that will help us to do the things I talked about. So it's getting there, just not as quickly and as effectively as it could be.
We'll end on that great note. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
You know, if there's one impression that I get about what Robert Merton was saying there is that we're coming into a crisis in retirement planning at the very same time that the government is going to be coming into its own budgetary crisis, meaning it just can't sustain this stuff anymore. And these two things are going to converge, which makes planning even more essential.
Well, this is one of the key points that we started today's Lifetime Income when we talked about that you're seeing a situation where what was once a dependable source of income, defined benefit plans, they went away. The employer basically said, you know, they put more of that responsibility onto the employee. Well, we're coming to a period. We've seen changes made in Social Security. We've seen changes made in Medicare where the government is moving more and saying, we're going to start pushing back this responsibility for your health and for retirement onto yourself rather than we're going to cover it all. So, John, this is all part of an upcoming trend, and it's going to be a reality check. And that's why you're hearing many of the candidates, well, this is an election year, depending on who you're listening to. One side is saying we can give you even more free stuff. Well, I hate to tell you, folks, it doesn't work. We don't have the money, as we've covered on the weekend show. But the other thing is that's either going to be forced upon the next president, because by the time even the CBO is talking about by the time we get to the end of this decade, the budget deficits are going to start escalating. I mean, we just broke the budget caps with the last budget deal in November. This year's budget deficit will be up by a couple hundred billion versus last year. So we're back up into the $600 billion range, and it's going to get worse from this point forward. So, John, you know, this is one of the things that we try to emphasize here in the program. Folks, it's incumbent upon yourself to prepare for your own retirement, because you don't want to wake up like what they just did last November, slipped a major change to Social Security. And most people don't realize how this affects women, especially. So there's the outline for our battle plan for your own retirement, folks. Don't procrastinate. Let's make 2016 the year that you put your financial house in order in your own retirement plan and get started on the right path. In the meantime, well, we're out of time as usual. On behalf of John Leffler and myself, we'd like to thank you for joining us here on Lifetime Income. Until you and I talk again, we hope you have a pleasant week.
You can subscribe to Financial Sense NewsHour in the iTunes and BlackBerry podcast libraries or at feeds.feedburner.com/FSM. Find more information about our guests at www.financialsense.com/newshour. Friend us at www.facebook.com/financialsenseonline. For our on-the-go listeners, you can access Financial Sense on your mobile device at m.financialsense.com. The Financial Sense NewsHour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the NewsHour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of James Poplava and do not take into account listeners' suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense NewsHour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertising with Financial Sense, or arising out of the use of any material on the NewsHour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.
Today's Lifetime Income program was an encore presentation of a previous Lifetime Income show heard earlier this year. Next week, we'll be back on our normal broadcast schedule.